Hello and welcome to the UK's number one science podcast. This is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's show, some really clever maths and number tricks to play with your mates down the pub with Professor Ian Stewart. Also, we hear from the head of Virgin Galactic.
Have you got an average age of customer over 50 and some of them as old as 89 in the case of Professor James Lovelock, who's one of the customers? You've got to prove that you can take these people to space.
Plus, what can we expect from the UN's climate change summit in Poznan? You'll need a pen and paper for this special interactive podcast. As always, pushing the boundaries of new technology. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Hello, everyone, and representing The Guardian in the studio this week, it's Nell Bowes from The Guardian's arts team. Hello, Nell.
Hello.
And this week's special guest is Professor Ian Stewart. Hi, Ian.
Hi there.
Now, Ian is a professor of mathematics at University of Warwick. He's so good at adding and subtracting that his teacher got him to sit mock A-level exams without preparation, and he still managed to beat the students he'd been studying for a year. This year, he's had two books published, Taming the Infinite, The Story of Mathematics, and more recently, Professor Stewart's Cabinet of Mathematical Curiosities. Now, I've been itching to get into some of these puzzles. I mean, I've been flicking through the book, and it's one of those books which I think you start by thinking, I'm just going to read a two or three, and then you end up reading about 40 of them over about 2 hours. But one of my favourite ones was something which is just a really nice description of number theory, actually, and that might sound complicated, but why I'm going to ask you the question that you ask in the book, which is, why does multiplying two negative numbers give you a positive number? And that sounds really for granted, we take all this for granted and it's obvious, but why?
We all come across this at school, and usually what happens is we're told, okay, that's how it is, you learn that, and here's how you use it. So you know, we're very happy that 2 times 3 is 6. It's pretty obvious that minus 2 times 3 must be minus 6 once you've understood what a negative number is. But why is minus 2 times minus 3 plus 6? It seems rather strange. And what I say in the book is there are reasons for this. You could simply arbitrarily decide that any negative number times any other negative number always gives 42. Why not?
Why not, indeed?
And the answer is
Douglas Adams almost did.
All of this stuff is invented by people. We invent what we mean by multiplication. Once we've invented it, we have to stick with that particular concept. But when we come to new kinds of number, we can choose a new kind of multiplication if we want. And the real point is, if any negative number multiplied by any other negative number is 42, then multiplying negative numbers doesn't tell you very much. An awful lot of our mathematics boils down to money. And negative numbers pretty much boil down to money. If you go back to the Indian and Chinese cultures somewhere in the sort of 400, 600, 800 AD period, they are thinking about arithmetic and they've got it into their heads that a negative number represents a debt. If I've got £5 in my bank account, then I can actually spend it. If I've got nothing in my bank account, then neither the bank nor I have a problem with that, except the bank's not very happy to have an account with nothing in it. If I owe the bank £5, I've got minus £5 in my account. So when I pay £5 in, it just goes back to zero. So negative numbers are like debts. Multiplying things is like making lots of copies. So if I have a debt of £3, that's minus three, and I multiply that by two, that's two copies. I've got two debts of £3, that's minus six. What's minus two times something? It means take away, get rid of two copies. If I get rid of two debts of £3, I've actually improved my financial position by £6. It's plus six.
Now, I'll pass you over to this building's biggest maths fan, Nell.
I don't think I count as the biggest maths fan.
I think
fan.
You do. You're the Carol Vorderman of this building.
But I did want to know what sort of... who's this aimed at? Who could... How much maths do you have to work out the curiosities in your cabinet?
Most of it could be understood by someone who's done 3 or 4 years of mathematics at school. You really don't, you know, sort of 12-year-olds and upwards... You need to be interested in maths, or maybe your parents have bought the book because they're desperately trying to interest you in maths. And anything after that is a plus. You know, the more maths you know, the more you'll get out of it in some respects. But it really is aimed at a fairly broad audience. On the other hand, I have put one or two distinctly more challenging things in. I had a long argument with my editor about one of them. And I said, the reason I want to put this formula in is because lots of people talk about this topic and nobody ever shows them what it actually looks like.
What was the formula?
It's Riemann's formula for the number of primes less than or equal
this
to
is
a given
Riemann
integer.
Hypothesis.
It's the Riemann hypothesis.
It's not been solved yet, has it?
It's not been solved. This is the most fancy thing in the book. It's 5 pages long, and if you skip it, you don't actually miss anything. In fact, you can start anywhere in the book. You can just dip in randomly. No, that's the whole point.
I think you do miss something if you don't read about the Riemann hypothesis. I mean, Marcus de Sautoy, another friend of this pod, has written an entire book about it. It's a beautiful thing, and I love the fact that no one can actually solve it. It's become this century's sort of Fermat's last theorem, isn't it?
Yeah, it's an extraordinary... It's actually a fairly straightforward idea, but you need some mathematical technique. It's a rather technical statement that there's a huge amount of computer evidence that it must be true. And mathematicians generally think it must be true. And nobody has any idea at the moment how to go about proving it.
Now, Producer Andy's got a question. Before I let him in, Producer Andy, do you know how to solve the Riemann's hypothesis?
Yeah, I did it on down the pub the other night.
Excellent.
We'll move
on to your question.
Okay. I've always wondered why our system is based around the base 10 system. Why do we have 10 numbers rather than 9 numbers?
Almost certainly because we've got 10 fingers. You can have any number as base. Computers use base 2. Martians with 7 fingers might use base 7, or if they've got 2 hands with 7 fingers, they could use base 14. There are a number of other systems are in use. A lot of people have been pushing for base 12 duodecimals for centuries because in some ways arithmetic's easier with them. But we're stuck with base 10, and 10's actually quite a nice size of number. But because you've got 10 fingers, you can count on your fingers. The Mayans in Central America use base 20. The suggestion is they didn't wear shoes and they counted on their toes as well.
Let's get back to some of those puzzles then. One of the fascinating things in the book also, and generally, is the golden number. This is a special ratio that seems to provide us with beauty wherever we see it. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, this is one of the great standards of mathematics, but it is very pretty. The golden ratio is it's 1 plus the square root of 5 divided by 2. It's 1.618034, and then it carries on from there, but you don't really need to know. So it's about 1.6. It's a fairly pleasant sort of a rectangle that's roughly 1.6 by 1, looks like a nice shaped rectangle. It's pleasing to the eye. There's a certain amount of exaggerated rubbish written about the aesthetics of this number, but it is actually quite a nice proportion. And it's very closely related to some very famous numbers called Fibonacci numbers, which came up in the year 1202 in a problem about rabbits. 2 plus 3 gives 5, 3 plus 5 gives 8, 5 plus 8 gives 13, 8 plus 13 gives 21, and so on.
And where else does this number, this ratio, turn up? I mean, does it turn up in physics?
It does turn up in physics, but in rather esoteric physics problems about the dynamics of certain kinds of systems. The most fascinating place they come up is in plants, in flowers. Lots of plants have the Fibonacci number of petals. 3 petals, 5 petals, 8 petals. Daisies often have 21. 55 is common. Sunflowers can have really big Fibonacci numbers, like 144, 89. So people have been really puzzled for a long time. You do sometimes get other numbers, but they're much less common, and they're often to do with the way the plant is bred. But plants in the wild, Fibonacci numbers are very, very common. And you also see them in the geometry of sunflower seeds. You look at the patterns of seeds, and there's a very interesting pattern. They form spirals.
We'll leave the mathematics of plants just there. How we got onto that from golden ratios, I'm not quite sure. But if I listen back to this podcast really slowly, I might actually understand it a little bit. Ian, thank you so much for all that for now. We'll come back to you at the end of the show. Just before we end this tiny bit, we're going to set Nell a teaser and the listeners, which we'll come back to at the end.
Okay, Nell. Yeah, suppose you've got a loaf of bread, but unlike usual loaves, this one is a perfect sphere. Right. And you put it in a bread slicing machine, which cuts it into equal width slices with a whole pile of... The slices are parallel to each other and evenly spaced.
Right.
OK? And then you look at all these slices. They're all different shapes. which one of those slices has the greatest area of crust?
Oh, all right, now, I'm going to have to go back
write
to school
it down,
for this
write
one.
Write it down, and we'll get the answers from Professor Stewart later. So Professor Stewart's book, Cabinet of Mathematical Curiosities, is out now, and you can find out things about the Möbius band and something interesting called a sausage conjecture in there as well. Let's have a look at some of the other stories making science headlines this week. Here's Nell and James with the News Jam.
News Jam.
Research shows that an ancient predecessor to HIV is millions of years older than previously believed. The findings from Stanford University's School of Medicine open a critical new avenue in the quest to understand the origins of the virus that leads to AIDS. It supports hunches that HIV-like viruses may be more broadly distributed among primates and other wildlife.
Scientists have created the illusion of an out-of-body experience. By using a trick of the mind, they've managed to convince volunteers they are inside the body of another person, or a plastic dummy. The technique may be used to treat phantom limb pain.
What's that fragrance you're wearing? Ah, that'll be fear. It's the smell of fear. It appears the clichés are true. You can detect when someone is stressed or scared by sniffing their sweat. I can't believe I had to read that out. Researchers took the underarm secretions of petrified skydivers and found that that smell triggered a heightened response in brain regions associated with fear when inhaled by volunteers in a brain scanner.
Nell and James, thanks very much. James is going to stick around for a bit to talk us through some of those stories. Tell us about the body swapping story, James.
Yeah, this is really bizarre. It's a kind of an extension of something that's already well known, which is the rubber hand illusion. Have you got a rubber hand, Alok?
I've got two, actually. Have you not noticed how I type? You're bashing the keyboard.
It's a bit like the English patient.
Yes. The idea with that is that you can convince someone that a rubber hand is actually their own, and this is kind of that writ large. What the researchers have done is put on the head of a life-size mannequin two cameras, and then the volunteer has two screens in front of their eyes, kind of a VR headset, effectively seeing what the mannequin sees, if you like. So that on its own doesn't create the illusion. To create the illusion, you get the mannequin to look down at itself at the same time as the person does, and then you tickle their stomach at the same time as you tickle the mannequin's stomach. So what the volunteer sees is someone touching the mannequin's stomach and a feeling at the same time in the same place. And that is enough to convince you that you are in the body of the mannequin. It's very,
does
very
the
unnerving.
Does the mannequin have to look like you?
Or not really. I mean,
can
you know,
be
it's
a woman mannequin. And well, man. It's getting a bit complicated.
I'm not sure about that actually.
Well,
but
they used man mannequins for the women, didn't they?
I think they did actually. Yeah, yeah. So yeah, obviously it doesn't matter. And they took this a stage further by then doing it with another person. So it's a person who's wearing the experimenter. In fact, I think was wearing the cameras on their head, and then, to really freak out the subjects, the experimenter came over and shook hands with the subject. So the subject can see what now feels like their own body shaking hands with themselves. Very, very strange.
I mean, how have these researchers been talking to philosophers at all about this sort of
not
science
as far as
of perception? Because that's big discussion in the philosophy of mind of how what your perceptions are, and if we can play with them in this way, then we could get some input into kind of what raw qualia are.
Well, I'd be intrigued to hear your thoughts on this because, I mean, the thing that's slightly disturbing about this is how easy it is to convince you that your body is not your own. Do you
Absolutely.
Know what I mean? I mean, that's really strange. I mean, you feel quite secure in your own body.
Under controlled conditions that make you realise how flimsy that sense of self is, then you can kind of unpack the sense of self much more.
I think, Neil, that's the interesting part, isn't it? That actually this demonstrates how easy it is to show that your brain is constructing an illusion for you. I mean, everything around us now, we feel and touch and smell, but actually we're ignoring, what is it, X percentage of the inputs coming in because your
brain
will go crazy.
That's even before we start thinking about dark energy, dark matter.
And, you know, because otherwise your brain will go crazy with inputs. So you kind of, your brain creates an illusion. It assumes things and, you know, it can't really see anything beyond your sort of central vision, but it kind of makes that up. Ian, does this sort of research sort of fill you with joy at the fact that we can trick ourselves, or does it worry you?
I think it's fascinating because there's a lot of interest among mathematicians and mathematically minded biologists in neuroscience, in how the brain works. And there seem to be circuits in the brain, and you can understand a little bit of the mathematics of how those circuits fit together. And this is clearly something to do with how the brain represents the body, your sense of where all the bits and pieces of your body are. And I have a feeling that, I mean, clearly the sense of vision here is actually rather important. The cues that are misleading the brain, in fact, are coming from vision rather than from what you feel, mostly. Now, if you have an internal representation of your body and you don't occasionally do a reality check on it, then it can just drift off into the wrong sort of shape. You could feel that one of your hands was much bigger than it ought to be just because the circuits aren't getting any kind of information on whether they're getting it right. So we look at our hand and we see where it is and what size it is, and this helps to kind of calibrate the system and keep it on track. And I think what these experiments are doing is showing you can use that system to fool the perceptual part into perceiving something that is actually not the case. You give it some cues which are telling it that this is the case. So the visual cues must actually be quite strong.
There's some really interesting applications to this, I think. And one of the obvious ones is in phantom limb pain, where people become, sort of develop the illusion that their amputated limb still exists and it hurts or it itches and things like that. So there may be a way of convincing people actually that limb doesn't exist. And then there are other things I think that are a little bit more speculative. I mean, you know, sometimes you come across, you know, anorexic people who are convinced that they're incredibly fat when, you know, to everyone else's eyes, you know, at 6 stone, they're horribly underweight. And maybe there's a way of kind of convincing people or changing their body image. I mean, that's much more speculative, but there might be something in that.
All right, well, James, we'll let you get back to your real body. You can find out more about all those stories at guardian.co.uk/science.
Science Weekly from guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
It'll be the flight of a lifetime. Soon science fiction will become reality and anyone can become a real-life astronaut, provided they've got $200,000 to spare. Virgin Galactic, Richard Branson's space airline, recently began ground tests of White Knight 2. This is the two-hulled aircraft that'll carry space tourists in a rocket ship into the atmosphere for blast-off. The company's preparing a test launch before Christmas. But White Knight 2 and Spaceship 2 nearly didn't happen. The original plan was to save money and stay with the original Spaceship One design, but Virgin's wealthy customers persuaded the company otherwise. Here's Virgin Galactic's president, Will Whitehorn, to explain.
This first group of customers said one thing to us, which was really important. They said, if we're going to pay $200,000 to go to space, we want to have space in the cabin that we're in to experience weightlessness. We want to do what we've seen in the movies. Now, that was hugely important to us. Because the original plan for Virgin Galactic, and very few people know this, but the very original plan, and the reason that you saw some publicity back in 2004 that we'd be flying people by 2008, the very original plan was to rebuild Spaceship One to take people up, because it was quick and easy to do that. But actually, they told us that as customers, they weren't interested in going to space in a tiny little spaceship where they couldn't leave their seat, they couldn't experience weightlessness. And that led us straight into the project that we ended up developing, which has taken a bit longer, but we've leapt straight to stage two, if you want to put it that way, because of what the customers said to us. And that allowed us to develop a vehicle and specify a vehicle to build that was capable of doing much more than just space tourism.
Virgin Galactic boss Will Whitehorn there. Another problem faced by the company was to make sure its aging customers would be fit enough to take the extreme G-forces they'd be subjected to during a flight to space. When they tested 100 of them in a flight simulation centrifuge, it turns out they need not have worried.
We showed that actually 95% of people are perfectly capable of taking up to 6GX and 4GZ without any problem whatsoever. And the fact was that one of the interesting things about data, and you know, you see it all the time in science, one of the interesting things about data is that actually, because all the research virtually on centrifuges has all been done with people who were incredibly fit, incredibly young, and incredibly healthy, what they didn't realise is because their arteries were so open and they were so healthy, actually, G-forces were not a very good thing in their case. They all tended to blank out rather badly. They had to learn how to cope with it. G-suits were developed. But actually, you put a lot of old codgers like myself in it. And in fact, because our arteries are so constricted and we're so unhealthy, we actually do rather well. So in fact, we should be sending geriatrics to space and not young fit people.
Science Weekly.
It's feedback time now. Let's have a look at the blog and Facebook wall. Blog first.
This is from Richard Edwards, 213. Says, I'm always tickled pink hearing the proposals of people like Mr. Goodall. His plan for covering the Sahara with solar panels to provide electricity for Europe. Apart from wondering why Africa should supply Europe with power, what happens to the Sahara under the photoelectric blanket? Does it freeze, killing all the wildlife?
Finally, Passy says, after almost 3 years of listening to your podcast, at last I hear someone kind of admitting that maybe the science is not so settled with this global warming thing after all. More CO2 skeptics as guests on your programme, please. And please do not ever say again that the science is settled in the climate question. Plus, because the religion topic is lacking from the last podcast, I somehow feel empty inside.
An interesting point you make there, Passy. I'm not sure we ever said that the climate science is completely settled. But anyway, on the Facebook wall...
James Talk has written, today I listened again to the podcast from September with Ben Goldacre. And I have to disagree entirely with Ben's opinions on science news coverage in the media. When I listen to the Guardian podcast or read the science pages of the website, I don't want to be bogged down with terminology I don't understand. I want a clear, concise outline of the topic and not to service the geeks, as Ben put it. I love your podcast guests. They give a great, exciting insight into their chosen field, and then we can Google for more.
Well, unwittingly, James has raised a very good issue there. Our entire archive is available online until, well, infinity, and possibly beyond. All that quality audio can be found at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And from there, you can also comment on the blog or join the Facebook group where you can post comments on the wall. Last week, the UK climate watchdog proposed a dramatic cut in greenhouse gases. The targets announced are ambitious, to cut Britain's emissions by at least one-fifth in over a decade. On a more global scale, similar issues are being discussed in Poznan this week at the UN Climate Change Summit. It's a chance for countries to pencil in the plans ahead of next year's summit in Copenhagen, which will replace the Kyoto Protocol. David Adam is the Guardian science correspondent, and by the magic of podcasting, by the time you're listening to this, he'll be in Poznan at the conference. But some days back in the past, he was with us in the studio. So I asked David for a bit of background on the Poznan deal.
Well, the Poznan talks are the latest instalment in an annual circus that the UN holds every December. You may remember there was quite a high-profile meeting in Bali last year. Poznan is the next one. And the really important one is, as you mentioned, going to be in Copenhagen next year. Essentially, Bali got countries to agree to negotiate a new climate deal, which is actually progress in the world of the UN. And they need to negotiate that by this time next year. So we're halfway through that process.
So this is going to be the roadmap to the big climate deal that will replace Kyoto. Tell us where we are with negotiations. I mean, different countries and things, are they all on board with this now?
No, not really. I mean, it's hard to know, really. These things, they move at a glacial pace. And essentially, the story has been pretty much the same over the last decade. You've got places like Europe that like to think of themselves as very progressive on climate change, suggesting Europe is going to cut emissions by 20 or 30% by 2020. But then the real two big players are the US and China. And essentially, their positions haven't really changed since the Kyoto Protocol was negotiated in 97. Everyone wants the US to commit to binding targets because the US, at the time, was the biggest emitter. Now, China is the biggest emitter. The US says, well, we're not going to do that unless China does something too, because that will damage our economy. And that's pretty much been the case over the last decade, which has held back the talks and held back progress.
We've got a new administration in the US now. Barack Obama seems to be much more environmentally friendly. 2 points there. We've discussed before what his environmental credentials might be. We don't know what his position exactly is going to be with regards to the Copenhagen Agreement. But given that he's not actually president yet, the delegation going to Poznan this week is going to be from George Bush. But do they have any power whatsoever?
Well, they're the official US delegation.
I mean, the US is what everyone's looking to, but it's kind of a hobbled meeting slightly, isn't it?
Yes, it is. I mean, almost everyone that you talk to involved in this at a high level says the Poznan is, it's not quite a dead rubber because there are some important things that can be discussed. But if you think about climate deals in terms of targets and timetables, who's going to cut carbon by how much by when, then essentially there's going to be no progress.
Let's talk about those targets. The idea of cutting your greenhouse gas emissions by 80% by 2050, which is the UK's position and California's position, actually. Where is that science at the moment? Is that going to be enough? Is that quick enough?
Well, it's a big question. Those numbers, you have to sort of backtrack a little bit. Those numbers come from a pledge made by the G8 group of countries to cut carbon emissions across the world 50% by 2050. And if you divvy that up between all the rich and poor countries, then that works out as about 80% really for the developed countries like Britain and California. Now, that's all based on science that says if we were to cut emissions by that much, we might be able to limit global temperature rise to 2 degrees centigrade, which is what we're aiming at. There are two things to mention there. Number one, that won't really feed into the existing negotiations, because what the developing countries are going to want from the rich countries are commitments in the next decade. They don't really care what we say we're going to do in 40 years' time. They want to know what we're going to do now and what we're going to promise to do by, say, 2020. And then the second thing to say about the science is that that 2050 target of 50% cuts by 2050, a lot of scientists are saying that that isn't enough. I mean, it sounds hugely ambitious. It is hugely ambitious. You've got to question whether we'd be even able to do it. But a lot of scientists are saying, well, that's based on outdated figures and what's changed. It's essentially, since 2000, carbon emissions across the world are going up much faster than anybody thought possible. Even the big reports from Nicholas Stern and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change a year or so ago, which are seen as the last word on climate change, their figures are essentially out of date. They used what are called emission scenarios. In other words, the sort of the experts get together and decide how much CO2 is going to go up over the next few years. And if you actually look at the figures over the last few years, they're way above anything what anyone thought possible.
Okay, well, there's going to be extensive coverage of Poznan from David at guardian.co.uk/environment. So back to Professor Ian Stewart now. Now, Ian, you set us a sort of conundrum for Nell at the beginning of this podcast. Nell, can you remind us, Ian, what the question was, and then we'll see if Nell's got the answer.
Okay, take a spherical loaf, slice it like sliced bread with equal width slices all parallel to each other. Which one of those slices has the greatest area of crust?
Nell, what did you come up with?
I, you know, instinctively feel that there should be some kind of simple, special answer. but I have to say, I've been fooling around with pi r squareds
and surface areas of spheres and
all. Oh my God.
It's either got to be the one on the end, the sort of cap, or it's got to be the one around the middle, the band around the equator, you think, because it's got to be special. Actually, they all have exactly the same surface area. This has been known since Archimedes, so we're going back to well over 2,000 years, ancient Greeks. What Archimedes showed was if you put a sphere inside a cylinder and then you slice through the whole thing with parallel planes like sliced bread, then the area you cut out on the sphere is exactly the same as the area you cut out on the surrounding cylinder. Now, with a cylinder, it's obvious that when you slice a cylinder, it doesn't matter where you slice it. You just get the same width cylindrical band. It's going to have the same area. And in fact, by using this, Archimedes came up with the formula for the surface area of a sphere, or at least the Greek version of it, which we would now teach as 4 pi r squared. Remember that?
Yeah.
Sphere of radius r, surface area 4 pi r squared.
I can see it in Nell's working. Now, pen and paper at the ready. It's puzzle time. If your social life revolves around fact-based quizzes, this is perfect for you down the pub, and you get extra points for working out. Now, Ian, take us through. You've chosen 3 from your book.
Okay, the first one sounds straightforward. You've got the digits 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 written in order on a piece of paper with some gaps in between. And you're allowed to put common mathematical symbols like plus or minus or times or divides in between those. And you've got basically 3 symbols, that's all you can use, and I want the result to equal 100 exactly.
Can we use brackets?
You could use brackets if you want, but I mean, a pair of brackets is going to use 2 of your symbols, so you've only got 1 left.
Right.
And you've got another one.
Okay, second one's about cats. I see you've got a cat, said Mrs. Jonas to Mrs. Smith. I do like its cute white tail. How many cats have you got? Oh, not a lot, said Miss Smith. Miss Brown next door has 20, which is a lot more than I've got. You still haven't told me how many cats you have. Well, let me put it like this. If you chose two distinct cats of mine at random, the probability that both of them have white tails is exactly 1/2. That doesn't tell me how many you've got. Oh, yes, it does. So how many cats did she have?
Final puzzle, Ian.
OK, the final puzzle is also about cats, but it's a logic puzzle. No cat that wears a heron suit is unsociable. No cat without a tail will play with a gorilla. Cats with whiskers always wear heron suits. No sociable cat has blunt claws. No cats have tails unless they have whiskers. Therefore, no cat with blunt claws will play with a gorilla. Is the deduction logically correct?
See, I don't know about logic.
Oh, I love this.
I don't know if that's logically correct, but it's just bizarre, whatever it is. You get extra points for showing you're working out. Your time begins now. Nell, stop looking at everyone else's answers. The answers themselves can be found in a special Science Weekly Extra podcast available right now on the iTunes feed, which is guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And we're not going to make you wait a couple of days. It's there, as I said, right now. Ian, thank you so much for coming in. His book, Professor Stewart's Cabinet of Mathematical Curiosities, is out now, just in time for Christmas. Thanks to The Guardian's Nell Bowes, James Randerson and David Adam. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.